Please be warned that this program contains mature subject matter and explicit language. Listener discretion is advised.
It was the first time in law enforcement history that the RICO had been used to take down the entire leadership of a prison gang that had a nationwide presence.
She had a green light on me, and she was find me and kill me.
A big part of this case was built on the development and cultivation of confidential informants.
If I show up somewhere, somebody finds me, kill me.
We had 73 indictments. Of those 73 indictments, 100% were convicted.
I believe that their command and control capabilities have been severely diminished. They'll continue to do what they do, and obviously we'll continue to do what we do.
And look what it did. I will be in fear my whole life.
You're listening to My Aryan Princess from the Dallas Morning News, written by Scott Farwell and edited by Mike Wilson and Leona Allen. I'm Christopher Wynn. Chapter 6, Highest Praise and Lowest Depths.
It was late, a few minutes before midnight, when Carol, her handler Steve Lair, and supervising special agent Pat Smith settled in around a boardroom table in a Las Colinas office tower. Eight stories below, traffic lights traced John W. Carpenter Freeway. "We couldn't have done virtually any of this without you," said Smith, the commander of Homeland Security Investigations gang unit, "and we're dedicated to doing all we can for you." Carol ducked her head, emotion building around her eyes. No one had ever praised her like that, at least no one like Smith, a man whose words carry weight in Washington. A day earlier, Carol had escaped from James Skits Samsel by locking herself in a hotel bathroom. Federal agents say the decision saved her life. Hours later, Skits, a general in the Aryan Brotherhood of Texas, had been arrested after selling a quarter pound of meth to an FBI agent, a bust primarily set up by Carol. The feds tucked her into a nondescript hotel room for safety. It was January 22, 2013. Carol knew this day would come, a day of reckoning, in the way people who live along the San Andreas Fault know it will eventually rupture. But she was still unprepared for the jolt of it all. Running from Skits, the ABT's highest-ranking officer outside prison, was an earthquake-like act of defiance, a moment when Carol's loyalty to the Brotherhood gave way to her identity as a government spy. In Las Colinas, Smith sat next to Carol, his 6-foot-5-inch frame folded into an office chair. He was flanked by an American flag and the Homeland Security Investigations crest. "There's a number of really bad people who are no longer on the street today because of you," said Smith, his voice a duet of bass drum and Georgia banjo. "And I can't thank you enough for that." Carol sobbed. In all, Smith said, the feds had wrapped up 36 ABT members in an organized crime indictment, and 29 others faced charges ranging from arson to murder. Carol's work clinched cases against at least 13 gang members, including Skits, one of the 6-year investigation's biggest prizes. Smith said her intel would pay dividends for years, but she would be in danger for the rest of her life. He offered to protect Carol by helping her disappear. "You need to drop off the face of the planet," he said, explaining how the government would move her to another city and pay 6 to 9 months of living expenses. "Where would you think of going?" Smith asked. "Europe," Carol said. "I thought of California, Seattle." "Have you given any thought to how much it would take to get on your feet and become self-sufficient?" he asked. Carol shook her head. "Well, have that conversation with yourself," he said, "and come up with a reasonable number." Smith told Carol to cauterize every relationship in her life, with friends and family, banks and cell phone companies, church groups and faith-based groups and Facebook, especially with her parents. Tears leaked down Carol's face. In an emergency, Smith said, agents would set up a conference call. "That way you could be in Kalamazoo, Michigan, or fucking Dubai," he said, "and they don't need to know."
Late at night, I'd go out my window and they would pick me up and we'd go sit at Denny's all night and drink coffee and smoke weed once in a while. And later on I did coke with him, and then his brother was doing heroin and I started snorting heroin, and that was it. I started doing heroin when I was 15. I'll always be an addict.
Carol swallowed the first handful of pills before she pointed her dad's pickup toward Denver. head swimming, hard rock on the radio, she pulled on a joint laced with synthetic marijuana and floated. 800 miles stretched ahead of her, a long road into the unknown. Denver hadn't been her first choice for relocation, but the idea had grown on her. Carol imagined a simple, healthy life, clean air and pristine mountains, tips dipped in snow, a place to purge old habits and begin a new diet, of daily hikes to strengthen her lungs and legs, a government job with good benefits, maybe a ruggedly handsome man. When sober, she knew none of it would happen. But the drugs that induced paranoia also produced vivid dreams with elastic possibilities. Carol left for Denver with less than $1,000 in her pocket, a fortune in her world, but far less than the feds had promised. Agents originally said she'd be paid about $40,000. They also pledged about $25,000 in government support if her mother, father, and sister moved from Collin County to Canada. Smith, Lair, and HSI Special Agent Steve Van Geem had pitched the idea at the family's kitchen table a few weeks after Carol broke free from skits. Smith did most of the talking. He cast Carol as the heroine of a true crime story, one of courage and patriotism, and said the feds planned to hide her from the Brotherhood. He said the family might be in danger, too. "They tried to persuade us it was a real good time to get out of town," said Ike Blevins. "They offered some money. It was all kind of vague, and I told them I'd be damned if I was going to let the ABT run us out of our house." In the end, none of it mattered. Federal money to pay for the moves dried up, forcing the local Homeland Security Office to fund Carol's relocation. They scaled her support back to $1,500 a month. The reversal left a bitter taste in Ike's mouth. He knew his daughter couldn't survive on that amount, and he'd have to make up the difference. Besides, he was sure she'd never make it living alone. Carol made his point about 2 hours into her drive to Denver. She tracked north on U.S. Highway 287, through the tiny towns of Rome and Alvord and Sunset. Medicine bottles spilled from her purse onto the passenger seat. Klonopin and hydroxyzine, anti-anxiety. Ambien, sleep. Tramadol, pain. Celexa, anti-depression. Haldol, antipsychotic. Depakote, bipolar disorder. And Neurontin, anti-seizure. Carol took them all, three and four at a time, washing them down with a Rockstar energy drink. She has a vague recollection of a Texas Highway Patrol officer walking up to her window, about 20 miles east of Wichita Falls. She was charged with driving while intoxicated. Ike paid her $750 bail and eventually bought her a bus ticket to Denver.
If you want to look at it, I never will be completely straight because I don't see a foreseeable future not taking medication. I am bipolar. I'm extremely bipolar. It does run in my family. I don't see my future without taking medication.
She arrived during an 8-inch snowstorm. Dragging a suitcase, Carol walked through the downtown Greyhound station, a room of hard surfaces, tile floors and cement walls and metal chairs. She stepped outside, away from the cacophony of ricocheting voices. It was April 15th, 2013, about 3 months since she'd walked away from the ABT. Four men stood under a breezeway, clustered against the cold. "What are the marijuana laws here?" she asked, a question within a question. "The drug is illegal," one man said, "but the law isn't enforced." Carol bought two joints and five Percocets and gave the seller her cell phone number. Soon after, she swallowed the pills and waved down a cab. "People say I just wanted to get fucked up, and sure, that was probably part of it," Carol said years later. "But that wasn't all of it. I was lonely. I wasn't sure of myself. I didn't have anybody, and I was a long way from home." For 2 years, federal agents had focused on Carol's every word. After she got to Denver, they rarely returned her calls. Carol's only tether was her dad, Ike. He co-signed her lease and helped her rent furniture. He set her up with cable and sent Carol cash every time she lost her purse or forgot to pay the rent. In all, he spent about $1,000 a month. "It was one thing after another," Ike said. "I wound up supporting her mostly while she was up there." By paying the bills, Ike enabled her addiction. She also got $1,500 in cash each month from agents. For one of the first times in her life, Carol didn't need to hustle or hook to get high. Until one Friday afternoon when she said two homeless men stole her money. By Monday morning, agents delivered another envelope stuffed with $100 bills and increased her draw to $2,000 a month. Even so, she invented drug-seeking dramas to score pain pills. Not long after she got to Denver, Carol arrived at Rose Medical Center in an ambulance. She said she fell in her apartment, lost consciousness, and needed pain medication. When doctors refused, confronting her with a blood screen positive for opiates, oxycodone, heroin, and benzodiazepine, Xanax, Valium, Carol dissolved into tears. Patient now insisting she is in FBI confidential informant program and they relocated her to Colorado, treatment notes read. Her story breaks down quite a bit and is inconsistent. She has very labile emotional state and gets explosive outbursts of anger. After giving Carol 5 milligrams of Vicodin, a normal CT scan, and referrals for mental health and indigent care, a nurse handed her a bus pass to get home. Carol demanded to see a physician, declaring her pain intolerable. A doctor wrote a prescription for 6 Vicodin. Like most junkies, Carol burned through cash. She scored meth and smoked it with men she met on Craigslist. She stayed up days at a time and crashed in coma-like sleep, her circadian rhythms set by controlled substances. She bought scratch-off lottery tickets, caffeine-spiked drinks, and cycled through friendships financed by dope. All the while, drug-induced voices dug at her insecurities, like a cross saw tearing into a tree. Carol ended up in a downmarket Denver hotel room, sitting on a bed, balancing a chunk of black tar heroin on a tablespoon. She added a few drops of water and fired up a lighter. The drug sizzled as it dissolved and smelled vaguely like vinegar. She drew the fluid into a syringe and searched for a vein not encased in scar tissue, needle tracks from more than a decade of intravenous drug use. Carol found one on the top of her right foot. The last thing she remembers is an incredulous question from a heroin addict named Brad. Are you going to do all of that?
I decided to do heroin. I decided to start doing heroin, and it just kind of all fell off, fell apart.
The phone rang, and a nurse asked for Ike. She said Carol had taken a street drug, and she was in really bad condition, Ike said. She danced around it a little bit, and eventually said they didn't expect her to make it. A man dropped off Carol's unconscious body at the University of Colorado Hospital emergency room in Aurora. She had a lethal cocktail of heroin, meth, and tranquilizers in her system. Carol doesn't know how long she laid in the gauzy area between life and death, her liver and kidneys threatening to fail. There were a bunch of doctors and nurses standing around, she said. I couldn't feel either one of my legs, and I couldn't hear anything. Her dad called every day to leave Carol encouraging messages. Nurses wrote the notes on a dry erase board and held it up for her to read. Carol can't remember much about them, except one. I love you, my baby girl. Ike cleared his throat when he heard that story recently. He said he never really considered flying to Denver, and when he thinks back on that time, his mind retrieves a feeling of melancholy. If I'm honest about it, he said, she has caused us so much hell over the years. Living with Carol is a living hell. I would have been very upset if she had died, but it would have been over. It would have been a bittersweet deal. Eventually, a high-pitched ring returned to Carol's ears. When people spoke, the words sounded like the screech of a red-tailed hawk. Her hearing improved each day, and feeling began to return to her legs. Doctors said her sciatic nerve was damaged, probably from lying so long in an awkward position. But with physical therapy, Carol learned to scoot around on a walker. After 5 days, and against doctor's orders, Carol said, she checked herself out of the hospital. A man she met online drove her home. Everyone had given Carol the same advice when she left Dallas. Don't come back. But after a few weeks alone in her apartment, she was looking for a reason to move home. She found it on the 4th of July. There were fireworks going off, she said, and it sounded like gunfire in my apartment. Carol called Van Geem, her new handler in Dallas, and told him she was returning to Texas. She could hear the exasperation in his voice. I can't stop you from coming home, he said. We can't make you stay there. Ike said Carol looked skinny when she walked in the house. She'd lost 22 pounds in 12 weeks and seemed as volatile as ever. Soon after, he stood in the doorway of his daughter's room. Ike couldn't make out much. The lump under the covers looked right, but she was just too still. A former cop and volunteer fireman, he walked over and instinctively reached for her wrist. Nothing. Carol's mom, Sandra Blevins, woke up when she heard her husband on the phone with a 911 dispatcher. By the time she got to Carol's bedroom and flipped on the light, the tension in her husband's voice and her daughter's colorless face told her it was serious. Time seemed to expand and contract. It felt like forever until emergency lights flashed in the driveway, but once they did, everything happened at once. 6 EMTs pushed through the door, radios crackled, voices leapfrogged. There were reports and pill bottles and towels soaked in vomit. In the skip of a heartbeat, Carol turned a calm house into chaos. In a nutshell, Sandra said, that's life with a junkie. We've been through so much, she said. You just can't get upset every time she does something.
I'm the one that screwed up. It's not their fault that I did drugs and nearly killed myself. It's not their fault. It's not their fault I was screwed up on painkillers showing up to probation. You know, it's not their fault. I did that.
By the time Ike walked into Medical Center of Plano, Carol was beginning to come around. She'd taken her month's supply of anti-anxiety and pain medications, about 70 pills. Carol continued to come apart in the next few weeks and months. Police, court, and medical records scattered around Texas document the self-destruction, like a debris field after a bomb goes off. In the summer of 2013, she stormed out of the Medical City Dallas emergency room after doctors refused to write a prescription for pain pills. And later that night, she punched Ike near a healing surgical scar on his back, knocking him to the kitchen floor. She attempted suicide by drinking tire cleaner fluid, fought police arresting her for drug possession, and wobbled so badly in court a judge threw her in jail until she sobered up. Government agents caught up with her at the Collin County Jail in McKinney, where she was serving a 30-day sentence for assaulting her dad. Pat Smith, the big Homeland Security boss who had offered to protect Carol 7 months before, said the feds were deactivating her from the confidential informant program. Carol was no longer entitled to payment or protection from the ABT. It's not personal, Smith said. We have rules, and you broke the rules.
A big part of this case was built on the development and cultivation of confidential informants.
So you always want to make sure that your CI's identity is never disclosed, or that the ABT, in this particular case, doesn't know who your CIs are.
I will be in fear my whole life.
But the feds weren't finished with Carol. A few weeks later, agents asked her to testify against Stephen Red Good, a former boyfriend she set up on drug possession charges in Kaufman County. In exchange, they'd see if they could get 6 months knocked off a one-year sentence she was facing for felony theft of shoes and jewelry from a JCPenney store in Odessa. The DA couldn't promise me anything, she said, but it was made very clear to me they were going to get me out. Carol took the stand in an orange jail jumpsuit. Voice quivering, she laid bare the last 7 years of her life, from meeting Crash, an abusive boyfriend who introduced her to the Brotherhood, to working for Lair, her main handler while she was a confidential informant, to taking down Skits, the ABT general who agents say issued a green light, an order to kill Carol. Assistant District Attorney Philip Williams asked her to assess the threat. How far in the future do you fear that you're in danger from the defendant and some of his? Carol interrupted the question. The rest of my life, she said. Good was sentenced to 30 years. He's eligible for parole in May. Prosecutors made good on their word and released Carol after she served 6 months of a year-long sentence. If the Brotherhood had any doubt Carol had betrayed them, an appeal of Good's case in December 2014 erased it. Details of her spy work are available online. Carol's green light, one agent said, is now a flashing green light. The bad thing for Carol is she crossed a guy who's hell-bent on finding the people who put him in prison, he said. Skits is all about revenge, and we know he has a long reach.
My Aryan Princess is written by Scott Farwell and edited by Mike Wilson and Leona Allen. To hear the remaining chapters of the story, visit dallasnews.com/ABT for direct downloads and links to our show and Apple Podcasts and other audio players. You'll also find exclusive DMN subscription offers at dallasnews.com/listen. Thanks for listening.